Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here today for episode number 429. In just a moment, I'll be sharing with you another conversation I've had with my dear friend, Barbara Carnes, who is an internationally recognized author, speaker, thought leader, and expert on end of life care. She's the author of The Little Blue Book, Gone From My Sight, and she's been my guest every other month for the last almost 2 years now. And so we're having another conversation today, and this time we're talking about myths about hospice that still persist in our society today. I think you'll enjoy this conversation, so stay tuned for that. I wanted to mention, if you're a regular listener, you know I've been talking about my need for a new laptop and a new microphone, and I had some technical issues when I was recording with Barbara, so the sound quality isn't quite what I had hoped it would be for the interview. So apologize for that. Hopefully within a few weeks, I'm going to resolve my issues and be able to get a new laptop. But I have been conducting the $10 for 10 years campaign, asking people to just donate $10, and everything I raise is going to go toward paying for my new laptop that I need. And it appears I need it sooner rather than later. I want to thank everyone who's made contributions, though, to that fund, and anyone who chooses to between now and the end of the year. Thank you. Thank you. It's really helping me to upgrade my equipment so that I don't have any glitches like this in the future. And I also want to thank everyone who's made contributions on my Patreon page and who has also been buying me coffees over the last few months. I really appreciate that as well. And to learn how you can contribute, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support. And there are three ways there. You can make donations and help keep the podcast on the air. A couple of other announcements. Don't forget, I have a YouTube channel where you can watch the videos of most of the interviews I've done over the last couple of years. From time to time, I share interviews from the archives that are audio only, that don't include a video, but you can listen to those on YouTube as well. And I also have a second podcast called What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality, which you'll find on all the podcast platforms wherever you happen to listen if you're interested in more spiritual issues. And that podcast is just a solo podcast where I just talk about ideas and thoughts and whatever it is I'm struggling with. So that's What Really Matters. Finally, in my conversation with Barbara, I reference a blog that Barbara recently wrote titled When Our Emotions Blind Us From What Is Happening. And if you're interested in reading the entire blog, you can go to her website at bkbooks.com and you'll find it there, When Our Emotions Blind Us From What Is Happening. So we'll move on with my conversation with Barbara. I'll come back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go.
Today, I'm so happy to be joined once again by my dear friend, Barbara Carnes, who's my recurring guest every other month, and I always look forward to our conversations together. And for those of you who don't know Barbara, though everyone should know her by now, Barbara is an internationally recognized author, speaker, thought leader, and expert on end-of-life care and the dynamics of dying. She is the author of The Little Blue Book, Gone From My Sight, The Dying Experience, which anyone who works in hospice should be familiar with. And I want to mention, just last week, I was in Walla Walla, Washington, and I made some home visits with the hospice there. And each patient had the Little Blue Book on the nightstand for their family members to read. I was really happy to see that. But that book is everywhere, thank goodness, because it's a wonderful book and it's done so much to educate families about caring for their loved ones. So we're also grateful to you, Barbara, for creating the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It was kind of, I'm going to say, divine order. It kind of wrote itself and got itself out there. And it pleases me very much that it helps so many.
Yeah, it came about, I think, at just the right time. It was very much needed and still is. And so it's in use all over the world, and it's really phenomenal. And then, but then also Barbara's newest book is By Your Side, A Guide for Caring for the Dying at Home, which is a wonderful guidebook for caregivers that goes in more detail into how to care for a loved one at home. Excellent book also that I'd love to see at every bedside. And you can learn more about all of Barbara's books and her videos and work at bkbooks.com. So Barbara, I just want to thank you once again for joining me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. I look forward to this. We have a good time.
Yes, it's always
wonderful. And I think we're doing good work in the conversation that we have, so that people can really get to understand and know end of life more.
Yes. Yes. And that's our goal, something we both care about so very much. So it's wonderful we are able to get together like this over Zoom and just chat together about topics that seem important to us. And today, in a moment, we're going to talk about the myths about hospice that still persist even after all these years. And we'll dive into that. But I just wanted to mention, Barbara, your most recent blog, which titled When Our Emotions Blind Us from What Is Happening, that details really the very challenging experiences that you've had over this last month with the death of your husband, Jack. I wanted to acknowledge that, first of all. Thank you for being here at this poignant time in your life and for still being willing to open your heart and share with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wanted to encourage people to go read your blog on the website, BK Books. So it's When Our Emotions Blind Us from What Is Happening, because Barbara makes such a good point. No matter how much you know about hospice or end of life care, the end of life is an emotional time. And we kind of can lose our way. And sometimes it doesn't matter what we know and what's in our heads, the emotions rule. And I wanted to bring that up because maybe that's one reason why all these myths about hospice persist, is because people only view it through their emotions.
Well, you know, I have all this knowledge on end of life, and yet I didn't want to see what was unfolding in front of me. I think that when we're dealing with someone at end of life, that our emotional element is we want desperately to give them more time than they have. And so that desperation really distorts what's really happening. And on a personal level, you know, I teach this every day. I teach this. And yet I gave my husband more time than he really had. I thought he had months when he had weeks. I thought he had weeks when he had days. I thought he had days when he had hours. It was the hospice nurse that came in and guide, and she was looking not through faded glasses, so to speak. She was seeing the reality without the emotional involvement. And I think that taught me, walking in the shoes of a caregiver versus the intellectual giving information, it taught me that our emotions block us from what's really happening. And part of hospice's work is to be that instructor, that guidance, to get the family and the caregiver into the reality of the moment. This is what's really happening. And it's a hard job because we don't want to see it.
And that underscores for me the importance of having hospice workers in your life no matter how much you know, and you may believe I can take care of my loved one by myself. I don't need a hospice. I don't need somebody else to come in, you know, and guide me through this. We all still need the guidance. We all still need the support on the one hand, but we may need guidance from someone who doesn't have the emotions that could be causing the blindness.
Makes all the difference in the world. And it neutralizes having someone who is not emotionally involved. It neutralizes the fear that all of us caregivers and family members have. Number one, we don't have any role models on what it's like to die. So we really don't understand what's happening, where even though I understood it, I didn't want to see it. And so I think that hospice is that teaching opportunity of for us caregivers of being taught and supported. And then they're helping us have a sacred experience, which becomes a sacred memory, rather than one filled with fear and regrets and what ifs and I should haves.
It is interesting, by having a hospice provider present, just kind of making some of the decisions and guiding you about what to do allows you to be more fully present, to just be the spouse and just be there with your person and not having to be in your own head, thinking everything through and making all the choices on your own.
It allows the family also to come together in a way that if, as a caregiver, you think you're the one that has to hold everyone together. As a caregiver, we tend to feel the weight of all the work on our shoulders. And having a hospice professional there who's not emotionally involved, it takes the weight and the responsibility off of the caregiver so that that caregiver can really be present with their loved one that's dying.
And I'm so glad that you were able to have good hospice support as part of your experience. But it does bring me back to just the types of myths and misbeliefs that people have about hospice, but it makes me think again, it comes from their fear, because I hear a lot of negativity sometimes from people in the general public around hospice who don't really understand the purpose. Like, we see all this beauty and how wonderful the support is and the care that's given. And then I sometimes hear negativity and people believe things like hospice is just where someone goes when they're ready to die and the hospice staff helps them die faster. And that is such a common belief. It surprises me in many ways that people still believe it, but I guess if they don't have any experience with hospice, they just make up their own story in their minds about it.
Well, and we hospice makes us see what we don't want to see. And when life is difficult and having someone we love die is a really difficult part of life, we really want to find something outside of ourselves to hang the responsibility for what's going on. And so it's the doctor's fault. It's the nurse's fault. It's hospice fault, because we don't know what to do with all those feelings that are generated from the fact that our special person is dying and we don't want them to. And so we're going to look outside of ourselves for a reason for this to be happening.
And I suppose if other people in a way, like you had the experience of other people believe their loved one could have had more time, but then they realize, oh, the hospice nurse gave them a little bit of morphine. Maybe that sped everything up and took away the time they could have had. And they blame morphine for that, but that's not actually what happens.
Well, and that's lack of knowledge. It's our society today that is dealing with narcotics and drug overdose. It's so in our face every day that then suddenly morphine's in our house and morphine is the villain. And who brought it in? Hospice brought it in. So much of hospice's work is teaching the benefits of morphine. And that's hard to do when families and people have this fear and this negative look at morphine. And what we have to do is teach that it has its place. Yes, it can be abused, but it has its place. And I've got to say this, and that is people on hospice, hospice bills and is reimbursed per day. It is not in the hospice's best interest to kill their patients. Just from an everyday money standpoint, it makes no sense. Their job is to support, guide, educate, and help a family understand that this is going to happen. Dad's going to die. And once we can teach what dying is like, hopefully we can get beyond he was fine and hospice came in and 2 days later he was dead.
That's so very true. And when people are not familiar with the stages of dying or what the very end of life looks like, it can seem very precipitous, like everything was fine. Dad was talking to me and then he died in 3 days. How could that be? Because they don't recognize all the other signs that were present all along that would have helped prepare or help them anticipate when those last days were coming. Or they may not believe the nurse who's telling them that.
Well, you know, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking of my own recent experience. And with all the knowledge that I have, I didn't think he was dying as soon as he was. I put off calling hospice because it's too soon, because he has months or he has weeks. And they came in, and with his respiratory difficulties, they started morphine. If I didn't understand the comfort that it brought him, if I didn't understand that the key to getting out of your body is to relax, all you have to do is relax and you can get out of your body. Morphine helps you relax. And once the muscles let go and relax, then we can be free to get out of our body. And people don't think about that.
In a peaceful way. And so, yeah, that's just one of the keys for people to understand. But also you make such a good point that many people still think that hospice is only for the last few days of life. And I've had people argue with me, well, I'm not going to suggest hospice for my uncle until he's right at the very end. That's when it should start. And don't understand hospice can be started 6 months in advance before the last days of life. But then I realized for a lot of people, if they've had a loved one involved with hospice, it's possible they were only in hospice for 3 to 7 days. Because that may be when they got referred by their referring physician. And so maybe that's all they know. They've only known people to be in hospice for a few days.
Well, and one of the myths around hospice is hospice takes care of people who are dying. And people don't look like they're dying until days or hours, sometimes weeks before death. And what we want people to understand and know is that hospice helps people live the best they can within the confines that their body and disease has put them in, which is why 6 months or months before death, hospice can do its best work, because it's supporting the family and the patient and helping them live with their disease, rather than crisis intervention in the days to hours, even weeks before death.
And if people understood the training that the hospice staff goes through, the medical staff is in comfort care. And the training is all around helping alleviate any symptoms the patient may have, whatever they are, not just pain. And the goal of that is when patients are comfortable, they're more able to have quality time with their loved ones, and they're more able to think about something on their bucket list that they might like to do, or something, leave a legacy or find meaning somehow in their lives, because they're physically comfortable and they're not completely exhausted all the time by their symptoms.
And I think another important aspect of hospice is that we just don't take care of just the patient. Our work, our support, our teaching is for the caregiver as well. And coming off of being a caregiver, it's hard work and it's scary. It's exhausting, and hospice can come in and guide and support, social workers, volunteers, home health aid, medical equipment, hospital bed, walker, commode, all those things that as a caregiver, months before death, we often don't even think about those equipments that will help us. Or understand nutrition, where months before death, hospice can guide a family into providing adequate, or as adequate as possible, nutrition, to teach that they're not going to eat a steak, but they'll drink an Ensure, or how much they're going to love ice cream. You know, that's part of quality of living, that hospice can guide this caregiver through to then provide the love and care that he or she wants to give to their special person.
That's so true and so very important. And a big reason why we're always encouraging doctors to make referrals earlier on in the course of an illness to recognize when a patient is nearing the end of life, so we can get patients into hospice earlier. But that means families and patients need to be educated sooner about this as well, so they understand and are more accepting of hospice. And I think another misconception around it is some people think hospice is only for patients with cancer, and maybe that is how things were in the very beginning when hospice first started. I think it focused a lot on patients with cancer, but that's another one of the myths that we need to dispel here, is that hospice cares for any number of diagnoses. It's just that all the patients are at the end of life, regardless of what their diagnosis is.
I think that the reason we focused on cancer when hospice started is cancer's more predictable than most diseases. You know, you can follow a line and kind of see how it's progressing depending upon what kind it is, when it was done, you know, all of those things. It's more predictable. ALS, heart problems, COPD. COPD, you look like you're dying tomorrow, and 10 years later, you still look like you're dying tomorrow. Horrible disease. It's not predictable. So I think that's how we started why we started with cancer. What has happened over the developing years is we've learned more about the signs of approaching death so that we can spot it in other diseases. And so we can bring it on. What's happening today in our learning process, I think the big disease we're trying to figure out and learn a trajectory for is dementia, because dementia doesn't play by the rules. And so we're learning how to put people with dementia on some kind of a guideline, but we haven't got there yet. That's one of our learning areas.
Yeah, that's very true. And I wanted to mention, because we talked about caregivers and how much help hospice is for caregivers, that as much as people sometimes have negative misperceptions about hospice, on the positive side, I think some people misunderstand and believe that hospice will come in and provide 24/7 care. And that can be devastating sometimes for families to find out that that is not true. And I wish that we could help educate people before they sign up for hospice so they have a realistic expectation of what hospice can provide.
Right. I mean, we do home care, but not shift work. We do support and guidance in nursing facilities, but we don't staff the nursing facility. We are supplemental care, not really primary hour-to-hour care. But then we have hospice houses. And hospice houses, I think, also has a myth around it. And that's it, that I can put my loved one in a hospice house and there he or she will be taken care of until they die, and it will be financially paid for. And that's a myth. I think hospice houses started out with donations, and yes, they let people come in and stay unlimited amount of time until they died. And then Medicare reimbursement got in there and started setting guidelines and would reimburse for inpatient services that you could call a hospice house, but they'll only do that for 5 to 7, maybe push it a little more, days. And there are now, which saddens me, there's a lot of hospices out there that will not take private pay. And so if you're in there for 7 or 10 days and you're still alive, then you either go home or you go to a nursing facility. And the myth is that the hospice house will keep our special person there until they die.
And some of the problems, as you pointed out, that have arisen are because of the financing of hospice and the Medicare benefit and the regulations it has and the requirements that it has. And so it definitely shapes the care that's available and that gets offered, though the benefit in many ways is quite generous. You pointed out before all the durable medical equipment that's provided, the home health aid is provided, chaplain, social worker, medications are covered. So the coverage is amazing, but it's also limited because of that Medicare benefit.
And today, hospice is really different than it was when it started. And I don't know how many people have really tracked its trajectory or how it's gone. And so the memory of what hospice started out and what it is today doesn't fit. And there's some of the myth and misconceptions.
That's so true. And I think you're right. I think these myths have arisen from a long time ago in the history of hospice, but maybe for people who had a more negative experience for whatever reason with the hospice. And because it underscores the fact that not all hospices are alike. And so we can't really generalize about any one hospice or another, because hospices can vary a lot in the type of care they provide and the quality of care. Even though they all have to meet the Medicare criteria, there can be a lot of difference between them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think when we bring a hospice on for service and for care, oftentimes we're expecting more from hospice than it can give. And that leads to disappointment and misunderstanding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so very true, because, yeah, there are myths about negative aspects of care, but these positive myths of hospice doing everything and being wonder workers in a way that are also not the reality. And so we need to dispel all of those so that people have a more reasonable perception of what hospice is and their expectations fall in line with what's possible.
Oh, you know, absolutely. Our work in end-of-life care is to get what end-of-life care is about out to the public. That's why you and I doing the podcast, educating people so that when the time comes, and it will, that someone's going to need hospice, then they will be entering into this with a realistic knowledge base. And so it's up to the hospices, I think, to make community education an important part of the work they do. And you know, going to churches, going to senior citizen communities, assisted living communities, and talk about hospice, what it does, what it doesn't do. I think that will help some of the myths that are hanging out there and the misconceptions that people have.
And I do think some of the myths come from the medical profession itself, because I know that there are lots of doctors out there who don't fully understand hospice or what hospice does. And every time I'm in a group of doctors, I hear someone say, well, I don't refer to hospice because I don't want to take my patients' hope away. And that one just frustrates me so much, because they actually are taking hope away in many ways by not referring the patient to hospice. And they can't see it and don't understand that.
Well, they are taking away the opportunity for this person to do and say what needs to be done and said, to put their affairs in order, to spread the love that they have for everyone. Let it be known. It's a gift of time. Everybody's going to die, every single one of us. And the gift, when we have an illness that we are going to die from, gives us the opportunity to say goodbye. Where fast death, getting hit by a truck out there, takes away that opportunity to let people know how you care about them. So I believe physicians are doing a disservice in saying we're going to take away their hope. I hope they can live their best life within the confines that their body and disease puts them in. I hope that they will use this time wisely and fill it with love and gentleness and friends and people. So there's hope there. It's just a different kind of hope than what a lot of physicians are thinking about.
And I think if the alternative to hospice is to pursue aggressive treatment that we know in many cases is futile, it's not treatment that's going to make a difference or that is going to cure the illness, we really are robbing that person of time because the treatments themselves are difficult to go through. It takes up all their time and energy to be in that aggressive treatment phase. And their whole focus is on getting to the clinic, for their treatment and then trying to recover after the treatment. There's no time or energy for the things you were talking about, being with their loved ones and thinking about what's important in life and having ice cream every day or, you know, doing the things that make life meaningful and rich for them.
Well, and I think not in every case, but there are situations where and I put treatment in quotes, actually speeds up the dying process. And the person through all the complications will actually die sooner than they would have if they had not pursued any treatment.
I won't say any treatment,
but have recognized when it's time to stop, when treatment is no longer helping, and then it starts to hurt.
And I don't want to oversimplify because it's a challenging decision to make and difficult, and I know you've just been through that scenario. So it isn't that it's an easy thing for anyone to decide, but it really helps if physicians, medical care providers don't come across as if they know all the answers. If they pursue the decision-making with the patients and their families with honesty, and if they're realistic about what to expect and what the outcome might be.
Oh, it makes a huge difference. And since we're sharing personal stories, I guess it's okay for me to say that when Jack was diagnosed with cancer of the lung, he's 89 years old, and just the procedures to find out what kind of cancer he had were traumatic and invasive and debilitating. That doesn't even count what the chemotherapy or radiation would do to him physically. So we said, don't even go in and do this invasive. If he was 30 or 40 or maybe even 50 or 60, we'd have made a different choice. But at the elderly, and I'm not gonna put an age on elderly, but the elderly, any bodily interference or trauma sets a person back and they may never regain what they've lost. But most people don't know this. They're so concentrating on cure, and there isn't going to be a cure for a lot of people. And so oftentimes our diagnostic tests provide a setback, a physical setback.
And that's such a good point. And it's so true and very much a reality. And it's been shown in studies that patients who receive aggressive treatment live less time than patients who with the same diagnosis who are on hospice. And so it's my main issue is if doctors could just be realistic and make sure patients and families can make the best choice for them, whatever it is, because fine, if people decide they want everything, they want all of the aggressive treatment, that's totally fine. And it's their right to make that choice. But I want to make sure they have the choice and they've been informed well enough so that they they can make the choice from a place of understanding what the options truly are.
And from a place of knowledge, accurate, true knowledge, so that then you can feel confident in your personhood, that I have been acknowledged and recognized as having the ability to make my own decision rather than having a physician make the decision for me. And so often it's the physician that is making all of these decisions based on their bias.
Yeah. And I would just love to see if physicians, even from the beginning, from the time of diagnosis, would talk about all options, including not treating the illness, that is one of the options that's on the table. Here are all these treatment options we have. We could go in any direction, but also not treating is also there as an option. Just saying that, if the physician could just say that to people, I feel like it would put the idea in their minds that it would be okay to make that choice. It would be okay to say, I really don't want to go through this treatment. It's not the right time in my life. I'm ready to say no to that. And it gives them permission to make that choice.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow, it's very profound knowing that you've been through this experience recently and you're speaking from deep inner wisdom. It isn't just a theoretical idea in your head. And I know that you understand, too, all the challenges of all the decisions that have to be made in the moment, and that it's not an easy thing, but we all need help and guidance as we're making those decisions.
Well, you know, I've worked in end of life for many, 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 many years. And I have a good knowledge base. And I think I've done good work, but it really, walking in the shoes of the caregiver for the last year and a half, really opened up a new door for me so that I could really see both sides. And I've always been focused on the person and the patient and not the disease. I now am broadening my scope to the caregiver and the family. And I wrote By Your Side, A Guide for Caregivers, when I first started taking care of Jack. And that was year and a half ago. And I have, in walking these shoes, I've learned a lot that I now want to broaden that scope and look at the caregiver. And part of what the caregiver needs is knowledge, is an understanding of what dying is like, what to look for, what to do, because it isn't like in the movies.
Yeah, even in order to be prepared emotionally for what is to come, but maybe even to begin the grief process, anticipatory grief in a way, as you're facing kind of one loss after another, watching these losses happen gradually over time, but to be able to really fully understand what's happening and then embrace any grief that you might feel during that whole process.
And not only grief, but to embrace the anger and know that it's okay, that you're going to be angry at times, that you're not going to have, you're going to be impatient at times, you're going to be frustrated at times. You know, we caregivers have this idea that we're going to just do such a great job. And then when we don't live up to our own expectations, that's an area that I want people to see that that's normal. That's natural. It's hard work being a caregiver, and it's not always positive thoughts.
Yeah. And you're so right about that. We need to talk about it, because I imagine caregivers out there who hold guilt inside of them, and they don't want anyone to know that sometimes I have bad days and sometimes I am angry, and they're ashamed of their own anger when it's totally normal.
Perfectly normal. Perfect. In fact, if you never got angry with the time that you're caregiving, I think something was wrong with you. You know, it's normal and it's natural.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like just a few weeks ago, we needed to have a document notarized. So we had to go find a notary public to sign the document. And somehow, just in those few moments that we were interacting, she mentioned that her mother had Alzheimer's and she's working full-time, but also a full-time caregiver for her mother. And she expressed with embarrassment that she was feeling really angry that day. And I realized, oh my gosh, like, you know, she's talking to strangers who come in to get a document notarized. I mean, but we ended up telling her, you know, we told her about the work that I do, which gave her permission to say that. But I just realized she has no one she can tell this to. That's why she's talking to us in this moment, because she's desperate for somebody who would understand and would know what she's going through. So you're so right. Caregivers need all of this information. I mean, our hope, I know, is that maybe caregivers can listen to our conversation, maybe as they're driving or doing housework or maybe going for a walk, they'll be able to listen to the conversation and feel understood.
Well, and I think one of our hospice myths is that hospice takes care of people that can't be fixed, people that are dying. Hospice takes care of caregivers. They take care of family, caregivers, cousins. You know, it isn't just about the patient. Where our healthcare system generally, it is just about the patient. So that's what most people are going to think, that hospice is part of healthcare, so it's about dad. But really, it's about the whole family. And I want people to know that.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. And that's the other reason bringing hospice in earlier on allows caregivers to get more support and to have someone to talk to share all those emotions with, to someone who that they can call when something happens and they have a question or they're feeling scared or they don't know what to do. Someone they know will come and visit with them and help them in the moment. And really, I haven't seen any studies on it, but I just imagine that caregivers are healthier who've had hospice involved longer than caregivers who don't get any hospice involvement until the very last few days. I don't know, but
it makes sense to me. It would be interesting because I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Yeah, just from everything that we've seen and that we witness. Mm-hmm. To know that you're not alone and that you have support and you have someone who's on this journey with you, helping you through it, versus just in the middle of the night being there all by yourself trying to decide what to do and how am I going to fix this situation.
Where they can pick up the phone and call hospice and say, here's what's going on. And hopefully that hospice will come and make a home visit. 3 o'clock in the morning. I learned early on, if you say, oh, everything's going to be okay, and not make that home visit, then you're going to wake up at 7 a.m. and find out that that patient's in the ER because family was scared and they didn't know what to do. And so that security blanket of picking up the phone and knowing someone's going to be there and guide me and support me, I'm not alone. It's so important.
Yeah. Yeah. So very important. So I'm looking at our list of I think, it's one of the myths that some people have is that hospice is only for the elderly. And as we know, anyone who works in hospice knows you have a full range of age range of patients, though more of them tend to be older patients, but hospice cares for patients of all ages.
There's pediatric hospices. There's nowhere is it written that only the old die from disease. I wish we could say that, but it's not true. And yes, hospice takes care of everyone, no matter what age. If they can't be fixed, I would hope that the family or the patient would reach out for the support and guidance that hospice offers.
Some people also have a fear that if they come onto the hospice service, they will not be able to see their own doctor anymore. They'll lose contact with that doctor. I think that's another misperception, but in a way, it's like largely up to the doctor you're seeing if they will keep seeing you as a patient. It isn't anything hospice requires.
Right. I mean, yes, hospices have their own medical directors that oversee team meetings and patient scenarios, but you keep your primary care doctor. You aren't just letting go and letting some stranger take care of you.
Yeah, and that's important to many people. Well, and I've been disappointed a few times when I have received a new patient on the hospice service and to find out their doctor told them, if you go on hospice, don't ever come back to the office to see me again, because we're two different things. And you won't need me anymore. And that was devastating to patients who'd known this doctor for a number of years and worked together to now feel abandoned somehow. But that's really a misunderstanding on the doctor's part, that somehow they can't stay in contact and stay connected to the patient.
Oh, terrible. That just hurts to hear about that, because it's just not the case. You think about our physicians, and healthcare. Healthcare is in the shape of a pyramid, and the physician is at the top of the pyramid. Everything the physician thinks, does, comes down that pyramid. And we, the rest of the healthcare people in that pyramid, often have the challenge, do I say this, of working with that physician at the top of the pyramid, that physician's lack of knowledge and understanding, and yet he or she sets the tone for all the rest of the care.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think people need to understand hospice is a team-based approach to care. So there's no one individual who provides all the care for a patient. It's a whole team of people, a doctor, a nurse, home health aide, chaplain, social worker, and could even be other ancillary people also involved, which is really different than any other medical care you'll receive anywhere else. The fact that a whole team gets together and talks about the patient's care, everyone has input, everyone just kind of decides together as a group how that patient will receive care. And that's one of my favorite things about hospice care. I'm sure there are some doctors who are not great at being team members. Even in hospice, that's probably possible. But it's this idea that we come together as a team and everyone brings their expertise.
Because everyone of the team has a different area of expertise. All the knowledge of end of life is not on one person's shoulders. It is not under the direction of one person. That's why we have team meetings every week and talk about every patient every week, because we want the input of this team that directs the care that we are giving, rather than just one person's approach to care.
And that even includes a volunteer who's often usually a layperson who doesn't have medical training. But sometimes I found the volunteers would come in and tell us the most important little bit of information that none of the rest of us had noticed or heard about, because the volunteer just sits and has long conversations with the patient and family. And so many times they would be the ones who would bring in a key piece of information that the rest of the team needed.
Well, and the volunteer kind of comes in like your next door neighbor would, like your friend would. Whereas caregivers, we aren't looking to that volunteer for advice or direction or instructions. We're looking for a friend, someone we can sit and have a cup of coffee with and talk about our feelings, come out. And then that volunteer will report back and say, oh, here's what's going on there. It's just oftentimes a lot easier to talk to your neighbor or a friend than it is to a professional.
Yeah. Yeah. So very true. But that just shows the breadth of this team approach and being able to get multiple perspectives on what happens and what's needed. I happen to think all medical care should actually be done in that same way. I think it would be phenomenal if every time, if you had a difficult problem you were trying to diagnose or understand, if you had a whole team of people who was considering it from different approaches. I think it would be amazing.
I do too. It absolutely would be.
So that's probably the last myth, in a way, is that sometimes people think hospice care is, it's giving up on medical care, it's giving up on life, and it's actually really a superior form of care for people who are at the end of life. And it's the best possible type of care that you could give to someone in that situation. And it's not giving up on life, as you said before. It's figuring out how can we maximize life given this disease process and where it is.
Yep. I hope that people listening today have got an insight into hospice services, because if you're or someone you care about is facing end of life, you don't want to be alone. You want someone who understands and knows about end of life to be there to hold your hand, to guide you, support you during that time. And that's what hospice does.
So very true. And Barbara, I want to thank you so much for just how generously you share all of your knowledge over all the years with all of us and help other caregivers, help hospice workers everywhere through your writing and then through these conversations that you have in various places. And right now, during this tender time, I just want to thank you for your openness and your willingness to share this part of your journey with us as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, be well, my friend, and take good care of yourself. And we'll be talking again in 2 months, or maybe we'll get together before then even and check in.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you and feel very close to you. And thank you for coming into my life.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Barbara Carnes. I always love talking with Barbara, and I am grateful to Barbara for sharing with us so vulnerably and so generously her own grief process that she has experienced since the death of her husband. And again, I want Barbara to know we're all here with her. Barbara is not alone at all on this journey. We're all with her and all sending huge amounts of love and support as she continues on with her grief experience. And hopefully we can repay Barbara with some of the love that she has shown to all of us over all the years. If you enjoy the content shared on this podcast, I hope you'll tell other people about it. Also, be sure to subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen. And don't forget to go to eoluniversity.com/support if you're able to make a small financial contribution that can help keep this show on the air. Also, I'm trying to keep this podcast free of advertising, and so that's one of the reasons that I ask for donations from time to time to help defray the costs of creating a podcast so that I won't need to resort to advertising, which I think in some ways for the subject matter we're discussing, advertising may be a distraction and may also detract from the experience of listening to these deep conversations. So that's why I choose not to have advertisers. And I'm relying on the generosity of listeners, and I do appreciate all of you. Thank you so very much. So I'll be back next week with another new interview for you. Until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear. Be ready for whatever life brings your way, and love each and every moment of your very precious existence. Bye-bye.